We're going to go ahead and get started back into our next session. I did want to offer a word of explanation, and I meant to do this when we started. I didn't purposely leave my family at home so you couldn't judge the quality of job. Generally, we go everywhere together. Obviously, the two girls are out of the house now, don't. But our third daughter is getting married in May. And the university congregation, where we were for 15 years, because she's a student at Bear Valley, she'll graduate in May. Her future husband is a youth minister in Tennessee. He graduated last year. And so their university's throwing her a wedding shower this weekend. And so they have that tomorrow afternoon. So they stayed in San Marcos and weren't able to come over and be with me, which they regret for a lot of reasons, the least of which is to listen to me preach. But to spend time with Daniel and Chloe, they certainly are sad that they're not here. But if they were, they could testify to some of the things that I mentioned last hour of having to learn and do things differently. But I do hope that maybe one day they'll be able to make the trip over here with us and you can meet. Shani Kay's been here with me before, but I don't think that the girls were with us that weekend when we came over. I think we left them with some friends and Katie when we came that this way. So anyway, just wanted to give you that by way of explanation. We'll start this session with a quote. Actually, this is the quote I want to start with. We'll come back to that. It's a quote from C.S. Lewis. It said, "Creatures are not born with desires unless satisfaction for those desires exists. A baby feels hunger. Well, there's such a thing as food. A duckling wants to swim. There's such a thing as water. If I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world." All right, we are created in the image of God. C.S. Lewis isn't gospel, but he hits on a human need that is only answered by Scripture, by God. We weren't created for this world, and we weren't created for the mundane routine things of this life. We have something in us that goes beyond the need for food and the need for water that we long for. We watch people in life search for those things and they don't find the answer. The book of Ecclesiastes is a testimony and a test case in that pursuit. I need fulfillment, so let me pursue riches and wealth and women and wine. And at the end of the day, the only thing that fulfilled that, the only thing that answered that call or satisfy that urge was to be faithful to God, to love Him and to fear Him and have a spiritual component to my life. Having said that, the title for this hour is "You Are Rearing a Worshiper." I believe, my estimation, this is the fundamental principle of parenting. I think it's tied directly to the concept of whether or not we are owners or ambassadors. We're creating in our homes a worship community. People who will praise and devote themselves to God. People who will depend on Him and talk to Him and rely on Him. And I'll be honest, it's difficult, isn't it? Because we want them to trust us, right? We want them to believe us. We want them to follow us. But at some point, we hand off that trust. We hand off that taking care of and concept of dependency, not on us, but on God. And so we're rearing worshipers. Our text for this hour is even more familiar than the one for last hour. Open your Bibles to Joshua chapter 24. I want to look at verses 14 and 15 of this passage, and it will serve as the catalyst for our discussion before we eat lunch together. If we do not take this seriously, our children will attach their affection to something. That's a fundamental truth, and one I think that we sometimes ignore. But he says, beginning in verse 14, "Now therefore fear the Lord and serve Him in sincerity and truth, and put away the gods which your fathers served beyond the river and in Egypt, and serve the Lord. If it is disagreeable in your sight to serve the Lord, choose for yourselves today whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served, which were beyond the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." All right, here is the challenge of Joshua. This comes at the end of Joshua's life, and he ends his book as any preacher would, with an invitation. Make a choice. You have seen God's power displayed. You have seen God's power conquer. You have seen God's blessings rain down. Now you choose. You pick. I believe there's a little bit of sarcasm in this invitation. It wasn't the gods of their fathers or the gods of the Amorites or the gods of the Egyptians that delivered them, that crossed them through the Jordan, that gave them Jericho, that gave them Ai, that gave them the north and the south, that sent the hailstones and stopped the sun, all those things in Joshua. It was only the God that Joshua was serving that did that. And so in reality, there wasn't much of a choice that they had. But he did give it to them that way. And it might seem a little strange. When Tyler or Danley get to the end of a sermon, and they offer the invitation, and they say, choose today whether or not you're going to serve God. Do they ever go through the laundry list of other choices you have? You can choose God today, or you can choose Buddha. You can choose God today, or you can choose Muhammad. You can choose God today, or you could choose denominationalism. You could choose God, or you could choose materialism. We don't usually give a multiple choice answer, set of answers to an invitation. It's either one or the other. You're with God, or you're against Him. So what's the point of Joshua going through this list, and how does this apply when it comes to my parenting and what my children are going to do? Well, there are a couple of things that stand out. First of all, there is a challenge about their past in this invitation. Every one of us comes to this point in life today as parents with everything that we've known, learned, and believed in the past at some point. Now, we may have unlearned them, we may have not believed them anymore, but we have that baggage. We have those memories. If you came out of a life of sin, if you struggled with alcohol, if you struggled with pornography, if you were someone in your teenage years or college years who slept around, you bring all of that into your parenting. And those are gods of your past, right? It's a challenge about the past. It's a challenge about the future. Where is my family going to be 10 years from now? Joshua could not have imagined where Israel would be at the close of the next book of Old Testament Revelation. Could he? Joshua's a book of victory. Judges is a book of failure, almost from the very beginning. But it was a challenge about the future, but it was also very much a challenge about the present, today. And if we're not careful, as we raise worshipers and as we rear our children, we will be so caught up in the past and the mistakes that we've made, or the future and wanting something different to turn out for our children, that we miss the moments of worship and reverence today. Growing up in a preacher's family, I used to say that everything in life was a sermon. No matter where we went and what happened, my dad could make a lesson or a devo or a sermon or a bulletin article out of all of it. What I didn't realize is he wasn't doing that for his ministry. He was doing that for his kids. He wanted us to see God at every turn. And there are practical ways that this takes place in our homes. It's a challenge for today. I've heard one writer suggest it this way. When you're cleaning the table, you're wiping it down. Explain to your children that in this way, God wipes away our sins and cleanses us. Let them roll their eyes at the number of times you bring God into the conversation. It's a challenge about today. Now, what I find interesting is that we live in a day when this type of challenge seems like a thing of the past. How many people do you know, if you were to quote this verse to them outside of religion, outside of the church, would say, I'm not a religious person. I don't worship anything. And that is a lie that Satan wants us to believe. I'm unchurched. I'm non-religious. I'm skeptical. I don't worship anything. Listen, everybody worships something. That's Joshua's point. You're going to make a choice. You're going to pick a side. Find an allegiance. Put your trust and faith in something. Now, if we had time, we could go through all the things that identify what it is that we worship. And generally, it's the things that we worry about, the things that we talk about, the things we spend our money on, the things that preoccupy our time. If our schedule ever gets moved, it gets moved to accommodate this thing. That's what we worship. It's not about what building we sit in. It's not about what songs we sing on Sunday morning, necessarily. It's about what gets our attention. There are a handful of books that are out there that deal with this type of thing. There's a book called Gods at War by Kyle Adelman. And he talks about the different things that preoccupy our attention. We have one throne, one seat in our heart. It belongs to God. When anything else sits there, it demotes God from that. There's another one that Timothy Keller wrote called Counterfeit Gods. Same mindset, same thought process. But they're both based in this idea, this Joshua 24 idea, that we're going to pick. Well, listen, if we pick something to worship, guess what? Our kids are going to pick something to worship. What preoccupies your children's daily agenda? Right now, our youngest has, she's 16. She has started talking to a not a preaching school student because they know better, but his brother who lives in Oklahoma. Her day is centered around getting home to FaceTime Solomon. That is her life. In fact, he hit his sister the other day. They were playing around, but he injured her. And they were playing around and got grounded from his phone. And you would have thought that our daughter's world was shattered. Because for a couple of days, he won't be able to FaceTime and talk. Her attention, her conversation, her agenda, her scheduling. I'm going to Oklahoma twice in May to speak. She's not the one that likes to travel with me, but she's going with me both times that I go to Oklahoma City to speak in March, rather, because she wants to see him. Well, that's at 16, that's generally what happens, right? When a girl is enamored with a guy or a guy with a girl, because that's the mental mentality of where they are in life. He is what she thinks about. Well, eventually, as adults, as maturing people, our kids are going to choose what becomes the center of their life. And our responsibility in training them in the way God has designed them is to introduce them and push them and encourage them to choose God. It's really the crux of it all. Now, to help appreciate this, I want to use this phrase and center on this thought. A lot of our parenting is spent, what I have termed, and I'm sure it's not original with me, what I have termed parenting upstream. And what I mean by that is this. Have you ever been, you know, in Colorado has a lot of places that look like this, and it's the beauty of living there. We're actually supposed to get 6.5 inches of snow some point today. And I'm sad I missed it. I love the snow, every second of it, and the cold. I'm all about it. But there are occasions when you come across places like this where there's trash, debris, and just stuff that someone's thrown in to the creeks or the rivers. Now, imagine if we were to come to this spot in the river and there was all this trash, and so I spent an hour cleaning it all out, getting it out, come back the next day, it's all there again. So I spend the next day an hour cleaning out, and come back the next day, it's there again. I can spend the rest of my life coming back every day and cleaning out the trash, or I can do something else. I can go back upstream and I can find out where the trash is being poured in, and I can stop it at the source. A lot of our parenting, in fact, I'm going to broaden the application, a lot of our preaching and teaching in the church and a lot of our parenting is spent pulling out the trash and not going. I've long said that I could delete half of the sermons or more in my library, in my files, if we could get people, if we would be churches, if we would be families that put God first. The junk wouldn't enter in because there would be a filter, there would be a barrier. And for our parenting, so a child's rebellious, throws fits, gets mad, wants their way, what's the problem? The problem is, at the heart of that, and I don't mean by 3 and 4 and 5 year olds, I mean by 15, 16, 17 year olds. The problem at the heart of that is God has not yet reigned in their life. It's still them. And it's the number one God, by the way, in all those books, in all those conversations, the number one God that we serve outside of God Jehovah is ourselves. It may manifest itself in materialism or sexual desire or laziness, but it's about me. It's what I want. And when Joshua was making this request to them, it really wasn't about the God to the Egyptians that they met, the gods of the Canaanites that they were now living in, or the gods of Ur that their fathers loved. It was really about themselves, because all of those false gods appealed to human desire and fleshly fulfillment. So those gods offer you the seat on the throne and take it away from God. They all do. And so the idea here is that God sits on the throne of our hearts, and we serve Him. But what we end up doing is we end up treating the symptoms of the problem. We don't get to the heart of the matter. We need to stop parenting upstream and go to the source. Put God in the throne of their life. But that means, and this is probably the most pointed lesson of the entire seminar, is we have to have God first in our lives, and they have to see that. What do we preoccupy ourselves with? What do we stress most about? What do we spend our money on? If our schedules get turned around and changed around, what takes priority? I only can teach them specific lessons like that through actions. I can sit down and tell them all day long that God is first, but if He isn't first practicality in my life, He won't be first in their life while they're at home. They may learn that somewhere else, but they won't learn it from us. And so I have to realize I'm raising someone who is going to bow down and worship something, who's going to give their life over to something, give their money over to something. We had an elder at university. He's still there, but he was one of my elders for a long time. He was qualified and worked extensively in counseling people out of cults. Started when he lived in the Northeast as a younger preacher. And after he actually retired from his regular job, he was a consultant. He went all over the country having interventions with people who had been taken over by the cults. And I would say, as a parent, that would be a fearful thing, wouldn't it? That my child had changed their identity, given all their money, moved to a different location, dressed different, act different, talk different to appease this particular group of people. But the reality of it is, they will all choose something like that at some point in life. Every one of them. Something will be the center of their world. And I need to raise them to give that attention to God. Now, that's probably not going to come if I make God out to be the bad guy all the time. And if God is seen as angry and vengeful and manipulative and overbearing and demanding. It's not the way the Bible describes it. But sometimes we end up doing that with our kids. And we don't generally worship and revere someone that we don't fear, but someone that we fear too much. If there's no reason to be in awe of God, I won't worship Him. But if I'm scared to death of ever being in His presence, I won't worship Him either, because I'm afraid He's going to kill me when I do. I have to find the balance in that. I have to allow God to sit on the throne of their hearts. And I have to get back to the source of it all. So let's talk, in the time that we have remaining then, about 20 minutes or so, a little bit less, about what it is that sits on the throne of our hearts that takes our attention and our time. I'll give you a book recommendation. I'll probably do that a lot. Obviously, read Scripture above everything else. It has the best answers. But there's a book called Competing Spectacles by Tony Ranke. He wrote it. Probably the most famous book he wrote was called The 12 Ways Your Phone Is Changing You, which is a phenomenal technology book. But he writes this book, Competing Spectacles, and it's laid out kind of weird. The chapters are about 2 pages long each. But he talks about there are all these things in the world that are competing for our attention and our time. And it's difficult for us to give true attention to what matters, because we're giving attention to the bells and the whistles and the lights and the sounds of our world. He even talks about a time, and he talks a lot about phones, obviously. Talks about a time that when, for example, you had been in an elevator, you might have 30 seconds or a minute in the elevator to reflect on the day, to think about the plans for tonight, or remember a conversation that you have. If we're in an elevator now, what generally happens? May not be true with you. It's true with my family. Pull out our phone and check it, right? Stop at a red light. Time to reflect and to think and to look. No, we pick up our phone and see if somebody texted us since the last red light, you know, that we somehow didn't hear notification. Our minds are constantly enamored with information and ideas and concepts and useless communication for the most part. to the point that God never gets the attention he deserves. In fact, when I was growing up, the biggest distraction in worship, the two biggest distractions in worship, passing notes and talking. And I don't know how many times I got in trouble as a kid for talking. Now, I know because I've got girls, they text back and forth. So they talk and pass notes all electronically. And then when you call them out for it, well, I was using my phone on my Bible. My Bible on my phone. Right? And maybe they were and they just got a text in. The point is, we have pushed God further and further out of even everyday downtime and conversation. And so it's no wonder he sits on the throne of less hearts now than he did 20 years ago. You have to spend time with him in communication and reflection and meditation and conversation in order for him to sit on the throne of your heart. And so I want to talk about one particular area that gets our attention above everything else. And I think that we understand this as Christian parents, but it is one of those things that I'm a little bit fearful to be pushy on for folks. But I can say this because I haven't ever had a conversation with any of you about these matters, that I can say this with blindness, okay? I know of parents who have overtly said, but their actions dictate that it is just as important that their children be financially stable as they are spiritually stable in life. In fact, their efforts and their energies and their conversations reflect the fact that for a time at least, financial security even supersedes spiritual stability. I'll never forget, I was preaching in West Tennessee, and I was 21, 22 years old. And if you've never been a part of a congregation that didn't have multiple preachers on staff, the preacher was everything. He was the older people's minister. He was the youth minister. He was the secretary. He did it all. And so I was not much older than the teenagers, and we had, you know, a room full of them at this particular country congregation. And so I did all the stuff with the kids, and we were close. And I remember noticing there was a family, a phenomenal family, spiritual, dedicated, at stuff, involved, gave, generous. And I noticed their oldest son, who was, a junior in high school at the time, he wasn't in class for several Wednesday nights in a row. Now, again, this is a place where everybody lived within 10 minutes of the school. You know, this is, you know, cornfields, West Tennessee. And so I asked his mom, I said, is Drew okay? Is he sick? And she said, no, he's got some tests coming up and he's got a whole lot of homework. And he doesn't have time to come to Bible class on Wednesday night. I thought, you mean he studies from the moment he gets home to the minute he goes to bed every Wednesday? He doesn't play baseball anymore or football anymore. He doesn't have his job anymore. You're the one thing that got left out. The one thing that got taken away when his scholarship money depended on a GPA. You know, the one thing that got pulled? His Wednesday night Bible class. I don't think they meant anything by it. I don't think it was intentional to demote God, but that's exactly what it did. Because you see, he has to have that job because he's going to provide for a family. He's got to buy a house and he's got all this. He's got the rest of his life to go to church. We have to be careful because our children pick up on those things. They're a lot smarter than I ever give them credit for being at that age. But they see through those things. I'm not standing here suggesting to you that if you miss a Wednesday night Bible class, now you stand outside the grace of God. I'm suggesting that the choices that we make determine who our children bow down to and where they give their allegiance. And if religious activities and involvement is secondary, without some type of full, reasonable explanation to our kids, and even then with that, they may choose to worship something else. And money is probably the number one thing. I said this, taught through this material at university, and had someone argue with me, which is fine. I don't mind that at all. I'm not right about everything. I may not even write about most things, so I don't take offense to that. But I don't know the God of money was the number one false God of a lot of generations before us. wealth and money. And here's why I don't know that it was. There was a time before the American dream became the American dream where most folks didn't anticipate moving up social classes or economic statuses. If you were born in poverty, you were just in poverty. If you were a slave, you were born a slave, you're going to be a slave. If you were born as a, you know, your dad was a blacksmith, you were a blacksmith, and that's just it. That's just the way life was. Your life was sort of pre-programmed out for you. You did what was laid out, and you really didn't have any choice in moving ahead. And so maybe there was a love for money, but the true desire and expectation of being wealthy really didn't exist. But now we live in a culture, right, where everybody can be rich. Listen, you get the right education, you land the right job, you might have grown up in poverty, you can own three houses. You can start your own business. You can strike it rich. You can pull yourself up by your bootstraps, and you can have anything and everything. What we do as parents a lot of times when we didn't come from that: I want it better for my children than I had it. Didn't have parents who pushed me to get good grades. I didn't have parents who pushed me to go to college. I didn't have parents who pushed me start a retirement fund when I was 18 years old. I didn't have all that. I'm going to do that for my kids, and I'm going to talk to them about that, and I'm going to ask them what they like in school. I'm going to let Sunday and Wednesday go, and Bible class is never going to be discussed at the kitchen table. Never going to ask them if they understood what the preacher said on Sunday morning. That's just a given, right? My emphasis and stuff is on education and on learning. I had a good friend in that same congregation who was, his granddad was one of the elders that hired me, some of my closest friends. But he was looked at by Major League Baseball scouts from the time that he was in ninth grade. And his junior and senior year, I went to most of his games, and there were always scouts there. The problem is he didn't progress in his junior and senior year like he did in his freshman and sophomore year. So the scout visits became less, and the college scholarship offers became smaller. And so he got a two-year scholarship to a two-year school. But then, at the end of those 2 years, he did get two offers to finish education and go play for a four-year college. And in the minds of his family, he was their ticket out. He was going to be starting catcher for the St. Louis Cardinals sometime down the road. And he had an amazing arm. I never saw a guy the entire time I saw him play in high school ever steal second base off of him. Phenomenal. He hit the ball. But he called me when he had those scholarships on the table. He says, "Wayne, I think I want to preach." I said, "Great. That's awesome." He said, "But my family is going to be mad." And so we talked and we counseled and we prayed. And he chose to go into preaching. He's still preaching to this day. His parents didn't talk to him for two years. Because I destroyed their dream for him. He was going to be rich. And they knew he was going to be rich preaching. He was their way out. He was their meal ticket. They had spent so much money on travel ball and so much money on private coaches. All that investment was gone because he was going to be a preacher. And now he just helps people get to heaven. All because of money. The wealth. The success. Again, they were still members of the Lord's church. His dad's still a deacon and active. But in their minds, those were two different worlds. Two different worlds. I'm thankful he saw the difference. Because I can't imagine the lessons that were learned behind the scenes if that was overtly stated out loud. And so we live in a time where wealth runs the show. Money is the answer. And so what can we do then to put God on the throne of the hearts of our children? How can we make them see that money is not everything? Because I don't think it has to be an either or. I don't think that our children have to be in poverty and be spiritual. Now, Satan would have us to believe that's the answer, that you're never going to get ahead, you're never going to be successful, you're never going to be wealthy if you don't give up religion and give up God and put all your effort and energy into working in materialism and greed. That's not... Some of the greatest people in Scripture were some of the wealthiest people in Scripture, weren't they? Abraham, Job, okay, and even New Testament men like Barnabas, who had enough to sell and to give to others. And so wealth and spirituality is not mutually, they're not mutually exclusive, and we shouldn't make them out to be that way. But if we had to choose, we need to help our children choose. I think there are several ways. We'll just walk through some practical things, and maybe you have some advice as well, because we're all in this together, right? Trying to raise our kids to see that God is more important than money. So here's the number one thing I would suggest. And all of this is extremely practical and take it or leave it. But take your children or your grandchildren on a short-term mission trip overseas somewhere. Take them to see where other people live who don't have and they're happy. Where the world isn't at their fingertips. Internet access. A plethora of restaurant options. Food that they love at every meal. And yet those people are happy. The first time that Shannon Kay went to Jamaica with me, and that's where Chloe has gone a number of times when we've been on a number of trips together. The first time that Shannon Kay went with me over there, there was a little boy sitting in front of us at Sunday night worship. And Shannon ends up connecting with the kids, and she takes candy in her purse so that they all like her by the time that we leave there. And they come and ask for sweeties, is what they call them. And this little boy, she was talking to this little boy, and she said, "You know, how old are you?" and all this. And he said, "You know what? I have two toys." And he was as proud as he could be of that statement. I've got two toys. My girls went. We took a family trip to Jamaica one summer. And I believe the older ones, it made a difference in their life. It doesn't change because when you get home, you're just thankful to have everything again. And you sort of go back into that mode and mindset. But take them on a short-term mission trip. Let them watch you save to do that. We're going to start eating out less. Because that money we're going to put in an account. When we get enough, we're all going to so-and-so. If you need a place to go, give me a holler. Bear Valley has 66 international schools. I'll talk a little bit about it in our next session. I went earlier in January to Cameroon. First time I'd ever been to Africa. It was an eye-opener. In the worship assembly that morning, there were about 300 people. They put the numbers up before we left. There were about 300 people there. 148 of them were kids. There's work to be done, and there's places to invest and to be involved in foreign missions. And so, you know, talk to your elders. I'll put your elders on the spot about a congregational trip somewhere where everybody goes and everybody participates. That's what we did at university. We went with four congregations in Jamaica and did VBSs during the day and a gospel meeting at night at one location. And we took people who were retired down to, you know, kids that were 5 and 6 years old to be a part of that. Let them see that. Show them that we can invest our money in those things. Become involved in the work of a children's home. And I don't mean by way of congregation. I mean by way of individual. Set a Saturday once a quarter that you're gonna load up two bags of groceries. You're going to go visit a children's home. You're going to give that stuff to them and let them see how other people live. Maybe if you support a children's home here, maybe it's one that you support. And representing the congregation and going and being part of that, show them that. Show them how you plan for your giving on Sunday. Show them the amount that you put in the plate. Let them physically be the one to place it in there. I know it's small, but let them see your money be active in the furtherance of the church. That, for those of us who give online now, that's a little bit harder to do. But find some way to make that possible. Highlight spiritual success more than physical success. Praise the young man in the youth group who leads his first prayer. Open of your children. Don't talk about the mistakes the preacher made that Sunday or the song leader made or how long the service was, but champion that song that he led that fell flat and he just kept going anyway. Praise spiritual success in your kids. Learning memory verses. Being ready for Bible class. Sharing with their friends. Those little things in life and make the spiritual successes matter. Give stuff away. Facebook Marketplace is the new friend of so many people, right? You can get rid of it and make $7 along the way. I have a good friend, and you know him, but I won't call him by name just not to embarrass him. He's spoken here a number of times, I believe. But he and my dad played golf together a lot through the years. And if they're ever in the same state, they'll drive 3 hours one way to meet each other to play golf. And this guy had a particular new driver in his bag, and my dad hit it all day long. Loved it. They got back to the car to put their clubs in the car, and my dad went to put the club back in his bag, and he said, "No, you keep it." And Daddy's like, well, we're not going to see each other. You know, we're, he said, I mean, keep it. You can have it. He said, well, it's brand new. You just bought it. And he said, every now and then, I give something away of value to remind myself that life's not about stuff, and you'll be happy with it. Probably a $350 golf club. Just hand it over. Let our children see a sacrifice for someone else. Let them be involved in making a meal. Maybe even give them chores and jobs around the house to earn money, and then let them take the money that they've earned to go to the store to buy the food to cook a meal for someone who just had a baby or someone who just lost a loved one. This meal is not from you, it's from them. And let them take ownership of that. Be diligent to let them participate. Adopt a missionary or a preaching student. You know, put their picture and letters on your refrigerator. I can promise you there are preaching students all around who would love $25 a month from a family that would invest in them and care about them. Once a quarter, send a care package. A finals package like we used to do at Texas State for the winter and spring final weeks. Coffee and, you know, beef jerky and snacks to stay up late at night. FaceTime with them. And let them know your kids by name, and let your kids know them by name. And invest in them and show them that spiritual component and connection to the money that you're using. Verbally acknowledge blessings in prayer, not just thank you for the blessings. Thank you for the house. Thank you for the money. Thank you for the cars. Thank you for the food. The things that other people don't have, the things that we have in abundance. Make it a regular thing to pray through your blessings. Don't belittle others for being poor or not having adequate clothing or begging on a street corner. My good friend Keith DeSargent tells a story. He is the director over the international schools for Bear Valley, but he tells a story on one occasion about eating breakfast with his family at McDonald's. And Keith's a compassionate, loving guy. And there was a man who kept table to table and asking for money. And Keith was worried a little bit about the safety of his family. He had his kids there with him and his wife. And the guy makes his rounds from table to table to table. And even before he gets to their table, Keith's already got his answer and his hand up, you know, move on, go on. And he said his wife gave him just the saddest look from across the table as that man walked away. And he got up and pulled him back and went and got him, you know, sausage and biscuit or, you know, coffee or whatever. And, you know, let our kids see that actively helping, but certainly not belittling someone. You know, we generally sort of carry ourselves with the idea that those who are begging on the street corner must have done something to get there, right? They're either addicted to drugs or scamming the system or too lazy to work. You know what? It might be true about everybody we see. Doesn't that seem pretty judgmental in front of our kids about finances and money when we take that approach? We can't help everybody, and we may not want to give a handout to someone who's just on the side of the road. But the way we react, look at, and talk about people like that in front of our kids determines that they're going to put trust in money or trust in spiritual things. Wouldn't anybody look at me that way, right? So I've got to make sure I have money, make sure I persist and pursue in life. Don't idolize the rich in front of our kids. I wish I had that. I would love to be that rich. I would love to not have the worries that person has. You know, the Bible says that with riches come hurt. Book of Ecclesiastes. And with riches come problems. And so don't idolize the rich. I'll end with this thought, and it's probably my favorite parenting illustration that there is. I've had to change the numbers over the years. When I first used this illustration, it cost, on average, $160,000 to raise a child from birth to 18 years old, not counting college tuition or anything like that. Now the numbers, within recent years, is more like $240,000. Now, if you don't have kids yet, I'm not trying to scare you into not having kids. I was told a long time ago, if you wait till you have enough money to have kids, you'll never have kids. If I thought I need $1 million to raise four girls, we'd just do something else with our lives. because I would say I would never have it. Now, if you do the math, that number, that 240,000 breaks down to right at $36 a day. Now, that seems a little more manageable, doesn't it? $36 a day, but if you have multiple kids, now that number starts adding up. What I want you to see, what I want you to walk away from this session is understanding what you get for $36 a day. If my girls were here, they would say, Dad won't get through this list without crying. And I may not. I've mellowed a little bit, which means I don't cry as much as I used to. I don't know. I've hardened, I guess. For $36 a day, and this list is not necessarily original to me, I've tweaked it through the years, you get naming rights, first, middle, and last. You get glimpses of God every day. You get giggles under the cover every night. You get more love than your heart can hold. You get butterfly kisses and Velcro hugs. You get endless wonder over rocks, ants, clouds, and warm cookies, and a hand to hold, sometimes covered with jelly or jam or something unidentifiable. You get a partner for blowing bubbles and flying kites and building sandcastles, singing or dancing in the rain. You get someone to laugh yourself silly with, no matter what the stock market did that day or what the boss said to you before you left. For $240,000, you never have to grow up. You get to finger paint, carve pumpkins, play hide and seek, catch lightning bugs, and never stop believing in Santa Claus. You have an excuse to keep reading The Adventures of Piglet and Winnie the Pooh, watching cartoons and going to Disney movies and wishing on stars. You get to frame rainbow hearts and flowers on the refrigerator, spray-painted noodles for wreaths on Christmas, and handprints on Mother's Day, and cards with backwards letters on Father's Day. For $36 a day, there's no better bang for your buck. You get to be a hero for just retrieving a Frisbee off the roof or taking the training wheels off a bike, removing a splinter, filling a water gun, or getting gum out of someone's bangs, coaching a baseball team that never wins but goes for ice cream after every game regardless. You get a front row seat to history. You get to witness the first step, the first words, first date, first time behind the wheel. And if you're lucky, you get to add another branch to your tree. And then your list will include grandchildren. And you get to do it all over again. You have the power to heal a boo-boo, scare away monsters from under their bed, patch a broken heart, police a slumber party, ground them forever, and love them without limits. So that one day, they will also love you without counting the cost. If we saw what we get for the investment we put in our children, I think it would change the throne of our hearts. God would now and forever always be number one. And we would want that for our kids. That's my prayer for us. We're going to have a prayer to close out the session and for lunch. We'll do that now, and then we'll make our way over and enjoy some time together for lunch.